Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Now look at the screen, we're going to see you. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we're welcoming back Alexander Stahil from Brugg Graben. Now welcome back, Alexander. We spoke back before the summer, I think, didn't we? We were talking really broadly about commodities and what was going on. And you were telling me how you'd liquidated a few positions and were preparing for a disorderly market for a little while. But then the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, one of the greatest moments to be alive, I recall that quote, and an investment required of 6 United States of Americas if we're going to go down the green shift. And I remember those quotes, and I always bring them up when I interview people in this space. But today we're not actually going to be talking about commodities as such. I'm sure we'll be doing that again in the future, because of course you are you have your ear very close to the ground on all things commodities and fuel as well, gas and energy. And that is very topical as we're about to go into the winter and people are perhaps just about starting to wake up to what might be coming down the track, maybe not the general population yet. And I did do a podcast with a company who are looking to develop hydrogen from economical means, so by hot springs in Iceland, for example, developing hydrogen. And he said that, and people will be very familiar with the TV series The Game of Thrones, he quoted a line from there saying, "Winter is coming, and there are a whole bunch of people who don't yet believe in White Walkers." So again, painting pretty a stark picture. So first of all, before we get into talking about energy and gas, electricity prices, that kind of thing, just let me know the kind of work you've been looking at, the kind of metrics you've been seeing over the past few months with regards specifically to the electricity market and the gas markets.
Yeah, hi, Mark. Thanks for having me back. Mark, we've done a lot of work in the last 6 months on electricity because we feel the epicenter of the European energy crisis is really electricity. Yes, Europe has a gas crisis because of the Russian-Ukrainian war and our sanctions, and in return, call it the economic war by Russia on Europe. And that is something we can look at, where we stand there and what it all means. But in reality, we probably have more so an electricity crisis than we have a gas crisis. And the reason I say that is because I think electricity is more important than gas. And hopefully we can talk about a little bit about that today.
So electricity is more important than gas. Why would you say that then? Is that because more industry, more people use electricity than gas? I mean, gas will be used to people to cook with, obviously, people to heat their homes with, if you're on gas. But also gas is used for electricity generation, isn't it, as well? So how come you think that the problem is more on the electricity side than the gas side? Because a lot of what I'm hearing at the moment, I'm in the Netherlands, is the fear of the gas rather than the electricity.
Yet. And I think this will change in the coming weeks and months.
Okay.
Why do I say I think it's more important to understand? Because I hope that when we do that, people prepare a bit and we can talk about that.
Yeah, that's important.
And if you are mentally prepared, I think that you achieved a lot rather than being unprepared for what may come.
Yeah.
And two, if we remember, from the classrooms that we all visited at some point in life, there was this Maslow pyramid that discusses the importance about, human life and what matters more and less for a human being. And if we try and do a commodity Maslow pyramid, I would put electricity at the very bottom of it. So the most important. I would say electricity in modern life is like air. If it's not there, you quickly panic. Mm-hmm. So then I would go and say natural gas is probably the second most important commodity of them all, because natural gas, as you rightly say, goes into the electrification, into the grid, producing electricity, but only partly. So the grid has many other assets that produce electricity. Natural gas also goes as feedstock into the making of fertilizers, which obviously then are used to make the food that feeds nearly 8 billion people on the planet. And then natural gas is also used to heat our homes and to have the gas available when we need it to make food, and so on and so forth. And then I would go one layer above and would talk about oil, which is about transportation, modern way of transporting everything, ourselves and all the goods we need daily. And then, but also about products that we touch and use daily that are made out of oil products. And then probably I would go about metals and would look at, either aluminium, iron ore, or copper, and would put them somewhere equally important, copper being the conductor of everything that made possible what we are doing right now. Together an interview, and so on and so forth. And then there are lots of other commodities, and some of them may matter in a specific moment extremely. But if you think about a life without electricity, it very quickly becomes very complicated. Like, how do you get your money at the ATM? How do you cook? Well, in Switzerland, I couldn't here. Because we use electricity to cook. How do you get security when there is no light at night? How do you charge your mobile phone and communicate with your loved ones? And so you can go on and on and on, and you quickly understand, wow, everything is about electricity really first, because you cannot even refill your car. Even if you had all the oil in the world and all the diesel in the station there in the world, but you couldn't get it out because that needs electricity to pump it from the station into your tank. So I think electricity is incredibly important. It's the most important invention that we only know for about 120 years. And yes, there are emerging markets that have very little of it. And their life is therefore different. But when you have it, it's very hard to go back to a life without it. Yeah. Certainly if it comes from one minute to the next.
Yeah.
And I think this is an important topic to understand and to prepare.
Yeah. But are you saying that when you talk about the crisis, are you saying that we're talking about blackouts here, potentially not having electricity, or will it just become extremely expensive and almost unaffordable for a lot of people?
It's going to be mostly the second. Yeah. And it's going to also be about shortages, because the operators, when they lack electricity, because we have a generation problem too, they will try and curtail peaks, and they will try to do that in what I call an orderly manner. Mm-hmm. But the more we will talk on this show here about electricity, the more hopefully your audience will learn that this is not a given, that they can keep it orderly. And that the modern day grid of the European Union, which connects from Morocco, the country your wife is from, to all the way to Turkey, and up to Denmark, and so 520 million households that are connected in a synchronous way. And those minute by minute matching consumption and generation is really a high tech modern miracle, and is possible, but can fail. And the more you throw at it, the higher the likelihood it will fail at some point. And I would say for the energy policies also on electricity have made it very likely that we are going to experience a form of shortages, high prices and potentially, yes, blackouts. And blackouts can be smaller and bigger. So a blackout usually is a failure of the system where suddenly electricity is not available by the next minute, as we would be here, and everything goes blank. And the operators couldn't prevent it from happening. And then you have damages that you need to repair. And then that's usually over-regional, and therefore it becomes harder to fix. Mm. The bigger a blackout, let's say we have a blackout from the Netherlands to as far as Romania, one big blackout, applying to say 300 million households, that would be a very, very hard exercise to get back up.
Yeah,
we have never done it, so we cannot know exactly how hard. But there are experts that talk about that. We are not an expert for blackout, how to get the grid back up, but. We listen to them and we take it very seriously. We understand that this is a serious matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my wife is actually, she's Russian, not Moroccan, but we won't talk about the Russians either. We might touch on them in a bit. I don't know. But so just thinking then, so if we are going to be talking about, because it's obviously a supply demand issue, isn't it? That's why prices are going to go up. And of course, blackouts would be where supply is lacking, the demand that is there. Why are we in this situation then? Are we not able to generate enough electricity? And why would that be? Is that from the gas problem that we have, the shortage of gas?
Yes. So interestingly enough, it's not that. I mean, we did the work originally on electricity a while back because we wanted to understand exactly, not roughly, how much gas we could save on the grid. Mm-hmm. The European grid at the moment, and let me look it up so I say precisely and roughly, the European grid at the moment has an installed base for which it uses gas as feedstock of 17%. And the rest is our other assets, such as nuclear, coal, including lignite. And then we have biomass, waste. And then we obviously have other renewable forms. And we obviously have runoff rivers, the hydro parts, water reservoirs, and we have wind, offshore and onshore, and solar. And all these assets combined make the grid and produce. Now, you ask, so are we not able to produce enough? And the answer is, yeah, that's exactly what we are at the moment. We are not able to produce enough. And now you say, but why is that? I mean, isn't that so important? And it is. But Mark, we had two developments that were ongoing behind the scenes now for roughly 20 years, in some countries for 10 years, in some countries for even longer than that, than 20 years. And I would put my finger on two things. Number one, an anti-nuclear lobby that grew and grew and thinks nuclear is a high risk technology that we don't want. Mm-hmm. And on behalf of all of us, that's a minority, but on behalf of all of us, they became a voice as if it's the majority. The anti-nuclear movement grew very strong in Germany and managed within the political games that are played in the parties to actually get rid of nuclear. And by year end, Germany will have gotten rid of 30% of its generation capacity. Germany is the largest grid in Europe. Because they shot in nuclear. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about the details there, but for your audience, by the end of the year, it's game over, and then maybe there is a bit of grid reserve. It's noise. They want to get rid of it. Then we look at the second largest grid of Europe, that's France, and they are the champions of nuclear, and they have 60 gigawatt installed, and they can produce a lot of nuclear electricity. But they somehow lost the touch and don't know how to maintain their nuclear fleet in a way that it has the output it deserves to have.
Okay.
For this year, we are at the level where they probably have less than 60% capacity utilization, where they should have, on average, 85, maybe even 90. The Germans run their nukes at 94. So the good ones we turn off, and the bad ones in France we still have, and they don't, somehow EDF, the operator, doesn't know how to run them. And then you go in the, to other countries, and in some cases, you know, you have a combination of these problems where they turned them off in the Netherlands or in Italy, they turned them off in the 90s and never replaced them and so on. So one problem, nuclear, where we become weaker and weaker, either in production where we have it or in terms of capacity where we turn it off. And then the second problem we have is what I call climate laws and the climate agenda, where in 30 years' time, we'd like to be net zero. We don't like to have emissions anymore, certainly not for the grid, but for everything else too. However, the technology to replace that is not there yet, and yet we turn off assets that we used to produce electricity with, like coal, like oil-fired power plants, and they get turned off, while the alternative that are supposed to replace them are not yet in place, or if they are in place, they don't do what they are supposed to do to become what I call an equal replacement.
So this is something that's gone on for a long time. This is not just because of what's happened recently. This is a failure over
of policy making, where the German Energiewende goes on. The Energiewende is this, you know, away from fossil fuel based or nuclear towards more or less two options, solar and wind, and you're allowed to have a bit of gas fired power plants to support the intermittent sources. But that's the Energiewende in a short nut. And that's 20 years ongoing. So we're in year 20 of it. So that's not, there is nothing new there. And then many other countries, like the Dutch, like the UK, like Italy, like Switzerland, they are on the same path, a bit more, a bit less, a bit more clear, a bit louder, a bit less loud. But they're all doing or going in that direction, while either the technology for the green shift or the assets or a combination of the two, you know, transportation of it is not in place. You see, the grid was never about assets only. The grid was always about assets, the location of assets, and the timing of the production of assets. So a grid is a minute-by-minute matching load, which is the consumption, with generation, minute-by-minute. And then it's about the location, in the sense that we cannot just transport electricity from A to Z without A, losing energy, and B, just without having the capacity and, in place. And if you start to produce a lot of wind offshore in Germany, in Bremen, you somehow have to bring it to where the consumption is of it, right? And then you have to bring it to Bavaria. And so are the transmission lines in place, yes or no? And the answer is no. So it's about the three. And when you have a green shift strategy, you have to work on the three. You cannot just say, let's switch the assets and neglect the other two. Yeah. So the timing of it and the location of it, and the timing obviously for renewable assets is uncertain. It's weather dependent. Is the sun shining? Is the wind blowing? Yes or no? While we don't have the storage, grid scale storage, I'm not talking, you know, our mobile phones here storage, I'm talking grid scale storage, to make sure that we can dispatch that energy when we need it.
So this is, I mean, the whole nuclear argument is, you know, from the anti-nuclear people, I really hope gets put to bed once and for all, because that is it is a green way of producing energy. You know, you cannot get a better bang for your buck, really, from producing energy from nuclear power. And was it only the other week that one was closed in Belgium, I think? They need energy, but it's closed because of policy that was set in stone years before. The UK, I remember when I was at school, we would talk about geography in our geography class, about renewable energy. But, you know, we had to fill the gap with nuclear. My teacher kept banging on about that, saying the UK needs nuclear power. You know, that was 20 years ago. And you know, we still haven't brought really anything to do, anything better on that. Now, of course, the UK government are now saying that they will, you know, go down the nuclear route, that they will now start fracking again to get gas because they need to, because they've realised what is going on. But I mean, this situation with Russia, then the Nord Stream pipeline, which particularly I think Germany and the Netherlands were quite reliant on. That isn't then the cause. Then you're not saying that's the cause of these skyrocketing energy prices, but it's exaggerating it.
We have to differentiate between the pricing effect of it, and we have to differentiate between the availability. We don't have. We could save their gas and then make the electricity grid even more strained from the current situation. But we can use the same amount of gas for the grid because we have, after all, we have some gas. We have less than we used to have, but we can still use it for grid purposes, which is important. And for instance, the Netherlands wouldn't have a choice because the Netherlands grid is really a gas-fired grid.
Okay.
I can give you the number in case you have some Dutch audience that are listening to you, and it's very important that each and every.
I do have some Dutch friends who might watch, as well as some Dutch audience people. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Dutch grid relies 50% when it comes to installed capacity on natural gas.
Okay.
Power plants. Which is, by the way, and then 13% coal, and then you know, some others. But and solar and wind is growing, but it's in terms of what they can help, it's still quite a small part. About 30%.
That's amazing. So 50% of the energy is derived from burning natural
electricity.
Gas. The electricity, yeah. That surprises me when you see the amount of wind.
It surprises me. It surprises me when you think about the fact that they are not opening up the power they have in the Groningen field.
In the Groningen field,
of course,
yeah.
The Groningen field has the potential to add 20 or 25 BCMs to their supplies instead of relying on expensive LNG. Imagine what they could save there and how much electricity cost the Dutch could save if they would change that strategy, and they could absolutely do it.
Yeah, I believe that's so running
The Dutch have a very special energy failure situation, which to me, as a rational person, is completely absurd. And whatever the problems are of the earthquakes, which are go up as high as 3 on the Richter scale, which in Japan they would laugh about it. What you're even talking about, right? I mean, the Japanese regularly have a 6, right, and move on with it, right? Mm. And then, so the Dutch have a 3 in one village because of a field that is kind of the lifeline of the country, and somehow the government and the people cannot find a formula to happily live with that field. Mm. Either by moving some out, because we in Switzerland, we also have regions where we cannot live anymore where we used to live because of you know, certain changes in nature, or because you just make sure that everyone gets compensated in a very, very fair manner and quick, so that everyone is not having to suffer about that financially.
Mm. Yeah.
That should, of course, not be the case, but you have to have a formula there where it has to be clearly there has to be more than just the failure of the government there to get things done. Obviously, there is, in my view, also a hidden agenda about getting rid of natural gas or fossil fuels, because the Dutch have a very green soul. That's all nice and fine, but let's see how that all evolves when they start to understand the consequences of their making.
Yeah, indeed. That Groningen field, I was told about that the other day by someone who actually is an entrepreneur who started a energy company only a couple of years ago, dynamic energy pricing. So it almost changes every day, this model that they're using called Frank Energy. And I asked him about blackouts because he's obviously sees what's going on daily with the prices of energy. And he says, I don't think we will get to that point here because there is that Groningen gas field that we can exploit if we absolutely need to. So I would hope that would happen if we actually did get to that point. But one of the things he did
say... How much further do we need to get? My question to you would be... I mean, how bad is this already?
We have walked already.
You say, you know, if they really need to, right? I mean, how much more need do we need in order for people to get on?
Yeah, well, how much more do we need? Well, that brings me on.
Prices are sky high. Electricity, gas, everything. I mean, the governments have to subsidize. They have to make additional debt to the point where they all go, don't know how to finance it anymore. And people really start to suffer this with. I mean, how much more of an emergency
Well, I agree. I can see it. You can see it. I don't know if the government can see it. I don't know if your average person on the street sees it. I mean, people are now starting to get their renewal quotes, if you like, from the energy companies, 10 times what they were, like 20 euros per month, now like 200 or over 200 euros per month. So people are now starting to see it happen. They won't feel the pinch for a little while. I think it's got to get quite a bit worse, I'm afraid to say. Almost to the point where there is like civil unrest, which I think probably could happen. And you might start seeing, I mean, the chap I was talking to, he painted a pretty stark picture saying that we could see some of the big energy companies, I think it's Eneco over here in the Netherlands, actually going under. Because I tell you what, they're not taking on new contracts because they're scared. They want to flatline their portfolio. They don't want new customers because they do not know how to price it. They're not publishing their prices because they do not know what's going to happen. I mean, this could be, I don't know, Lehman Brothers, but in the energy sector. I don't know.
It's already happening, right? This is already happening in Germany, where one utility after the other needs a bailout from the state and nationalization. Mm. We had already 3 announcements in Germany alone, and one after the other lines up to do the same. Why? Because they got delivered the gas from Russia they were supposed to, and then they had to buy it a much, much more expensive in the market, while at the same time, clients still had a contract where they had to deliver the gas cheaper than what they had to buy it for in the market. So the difference immediately puts them into insolvency.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a bad situation. We were talking before, weren't we, about how these prices can spiral out of control. You talked about a potential short squeeze happening in the energy market.
Well, we're in there. If certain utilities have for the years, over decades, tried to de-risk the business in a way that they would what is called in English, you know, hedge out the position in, say, in the winter months to come, to make absolutely sure that the electricity or the gas they deliver in 3 months' time, they know exactly the profit they are going to have. And so you usually do that with a swap, where you exactly take the volume and then you swap out, so to speak, the revenue side that you are going to make from delivering those molecules in, say, 3 months' time. Now, the problem is, what happened is that the prices for these electricity months ahead have gone up drastically, much, much more than expected, than ever seen, ever in the history of Europe. And so now suddenly the banks call them and say, by the way, you have this swap rate there, which actually doesn't cost you much and usually only have a collateral of 2% as a security for us as a bank, that we know that you're going to come up with the money when you need it. And they usually say, we don't need to pay it now, we pay it in 3 months when we sold the electricity, don't worry. And then we get our revenues, then we pay the bank. Now the bank suddenly says, by the way, you know, your collateral requirement goes up a little bit because it's still the volume, but the price has shot up 12 times. So the overall is now much more, and it's still 5% of that overall much more. So can you please send us another billion or two? Only collateral, don't worry, you're going to make it back in month. Mm. And now the governments come and say, by the way, we want to tax you on this, what we call super windfall that you are currently making, that you shouldn't make because consumers don't even know how to pay it, and so on and so forth. And so they're all sitting there and saying, oh, what do we do now? Let's buy back that swap. And so now they chase the price higher because they have to buy back their own contracts. It was originally only there to hedge out a boring position And to make sure you know exactly the profit you're going to have. And now by now it has become nothing but a problem. You don't have the collateral. You're illiquid to send the bank additional collateral. So they call the state and say, by the way, we need liquidity in order to provide it to the bank. Then these guys call the bank and say, can you not stop this silliness with the collateral you need? And bank says, sorry, we're a private enterprise. We have to make, we are responsible versus our own shareholders. We have to make sure these guys come up with the money and we don't go bankrupt. And so it goes from one to the next to the next, and no one knows the solutions for the problems anymore. And the prices in the meantime, when they buy them back, goes higher. And so the problem becomes bigger.
Yeah, you have this crazy spiral, and like slowly but surely, destruction sort of goes all around the world before you know it. It is interesting that we have this windfall tax, certainly in Europe, don't we? Taxing the profits of energy companies, when at the same time the energy companies are really scared about how they are going to stay liquid throughout the next year. Right.
And they need probably help. And they may get it because the governments have no choice.
So they'll get a windfall tax, and then they'll get bailed out.
Yes, and I think the key you said before is that the consumer's only going to see what it all means in someone's time.
Yeah,
the UK consumer, the European consumer, it all is yet to arrive at the household level. Yes. Some of it has arrived, but in actually quite small increments. Wait until this 10 times, 12 times, 15 times factor really comes in, where households simply cannot pay the bill. And then what? And that's why I said we are, because this is our job to know these things, we already know the crisis couldn't become bigger. This is an existential crisis, perhaps even for the euro. You know, the combination of the gas crisis plus the electricity crisis, which is, as I said, like air, it's going to hurt every single consumer out there and certainly the industry. It's going to cause unemployment, sadly. So we don't have good news here to come.
No.
And it needs politicians to really stop what I call the brinkmanship, where someone says, by the way, we don't really like this Groningen gas field, as if we have choices here. We don't have them. We need to bring on, as you rightly said, everything that we have in order to quickly get those prices back under control. And yet we have in the electricity market those fundamental movements on climate laws, which makes utilities behave differently because they should get rid of natural gas, they should get rid of coal assets that provide electricity. And at the same time, we have the nuclear, call it crisis of confidence, where we can perceive it somehow after years of media coverage as being a high-risk technology, as if we don't want it anymore, when A, we don't have a choice because we don't know how to replace the energy density that nuclear gives, we just don't know, and B, we don't have choices because now with the situation in Russia, our energy options have reduced, and certainly on the natural gas side, which in a way we want to get rid of this 17% natural gas price electricity, which causes the entire electricity price to go up. And so you actually want to get rid of natural gas as a source of electricity. But we cannot, because we don't have the choices. And this is the big disaster that we created, that it has been in the making for 15 years, where we pretended or were told we can do an Energiewende that we actually not ready yet to do.
Yeah. No, it's a crisis in the long time in the making. We've talked a lot there about sort of Central Europe. I do want to talk a little bit about the UK, but also, What's the difference, would you say, in sort of Northern Europe, sort of Scandinavia? The energy prices there, just looking at the spot, are considerably lower than sort of Western Europe. So before we talk about the UK, what would you make of that?
Yeah, look, the Scandinavians, let's talk about Scandinavia, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. They have, and then we should include there the Baltics too. they have a different situation. Now, the three smaller Baltic ones, they are net importers of electricity, but Sweden and Norway in particular can help. Finland is still a net importer, but has now reduced that with one new nuclear plant, one of only three in Europe that is currently starting up, one in Finland, two in Slovakia. We just wrote a tweet today about one of them in Slovakia, where there is for another moment to speak about. And in Sweden and Norway are net exporters of electricity. Why? Because they have those wonderful water reservoirs and run of rivers, like Switzerland. So they have the relief, so to speak, the, you know, we have it in Switzerland from the Alps, and they have it from their own fjords and the way the geography there is, that they have incredibly powerful water resources that they can use for electricity purposes, and they do so very successfully for decades of years. That means Norway in particular is a net exporter of electricity. Now, sadly, and as always, Murphy's Law, when things go wrong, everything goes wrong at the same time. This year in particular, Norway also suffered is about to suffer from low water levels in two of its five regions that have those water reservoirs. And therefore, the minister of Norway the other day actually said, was about 6 or 7 weeks ago, where he said he's not sure he can provide the same exports, mainly to the continent of Europe, this time around in the winter, because their water levels are too low, so therefore they have less power stored in those water levels. We'll see how it pans out. Sweden is unchanged from last year. So yes, the house is in order, and yes, it can provide exports, but it's obviously on the European scale not going to change the needle.
Yeah.
And so that's the Scandinavian situation. The Scandinavians have their own grid. So the European grid is one, the UK and Ireland grid is one, and then we have the Scandinavian grid, which, by the way, all of them are connected to each other in all sorts of ways. But when I say they have their own grid, it means the synchronized aspect of it. So the minute by minute being synchronized also means there is your blackout risk. So if something goes wrong in Germany, it might as well go in the same minute wrong in Switzerland or in Spain.
Okay.
Right? So that's important for your audience to understand. Whatever goes wrong in Scandinavia can never have an effect on our grid, or the other way around. Whatever goes wrong here will never affect the electricity situation in Scandinavia or Norway when there is an accident, right? When there is a blackout situation where by 1 minute, from 1 minute to the next, the grid, the operators failed to solve the problem they had to solve when it comes to matching load and consumption.
Okay.
Sorry, consumption and generation. So that's the Scandinavian situation, and let's hope it cannot improve in Norway, but let's hope it stays stable.
Yeah, okay.
And it doesn't get worse. So we at least have some exports that we can count on from the Scandis.
Yes.
And yes. I think we do, because the Finns have now, after 17 years of working on it, finally a new nuclear plant that they're going to start up. So they become less of a net importer, and hopefully that will free up some capacity sent from Sweden to Finland that now can come our way. So that's the good news there. And then we can talk about the UK if you want for a moment.
Yeah, the UK. I didn't know about the different grids there. That's very interesting. You say Europe, Scandinavia, and the UK and Ireland there on different grids. So yeah, let's talk about the UK. The government seemed to be a little bit slightly more ahead, maybe than Europe, because it's now left the European Union. It can maybe move quicker with the legislation. They have announced an energy price cap. They are starting to frack again to get gas, but something interesting I read on one of your tweets was, and I checked it on the data there, that the UK only has, even at 100% capacity, 100% storage, the UK only has 4 days of gas, so it needs inflows. So what's the situation in UK, do you think, for the moment?
Okay, let's do gas and then let's talk electricity in that connection. So the UK is the third largest consumer of natural gas in Europe.
Okay.
It can afford so because it has two things going for it. Number one, it has its own production, which covers about half the gas needs in the UK from the North Sea mainly. And then it also has pipeline systems directly going from the Norway into the UK. So Norway obviously delivers also a large part into the continent, but it also directly delivers into the UK. So that's going for the UK. And then it has LNG terminals, which are quite potent. They can become even better, and they should become these regasification terminals bigger. But the UK there has the third leg, so to speak, where it imports gas from. So it was never about Russia. So in that sense, it's less affected by the lack of Russian gas. Having said that, the UK also needed at times imports and exports from Norway, of course, and then also from the continent at times in extreme weather situations, mainly in the winter. They're all connected again. They're all talking to each other. They're all exchanging, which is fine. It's make it one big market that usually leads to certain efficiency. But it also means the UK has high prices. And it anyway is going to have high prices because the UK LNG that goes into the UK and is often, by the way, exported then into the continent for storage purposes or just for consumption purposes. But that same LNG obviously competes with the continental need for LNG. And therefore, those prices are always very similar. So UK prices and European continent prices, which we measure in title transfer facility, the thing in the Netherlands, ETF, and the NBP price for the UK, they are more or less the same, except that there are two prices and at times they have slight differences.
Okay.
That's the UK situation. And off that now, let's talk about the grid of the UK. Your second question, the UK has a gas grid. That's okay. Not good. Because, if the UK wouldn't have any gas in its grid, so no gas-fired plant to produce out of gas electricity, it wouldn't be affected what is happening at the moment for expensive gas prices at the electricity side. So the electricity bill that comes to UK homeowners would at least not be affected. But because it has such a large percentage of gas in it, in fact, 42% of the UK grid is gas-fired.
42%, okay.
It's a very high number in a European context. The second highest after the Netherlands.
After the Netherlands, yeah.
So those two are really the two bad ones. And Italy is also bad. And it's about the same in between the two. And so those 42% you cannot get rid of. You cannot just say, let's bring on all the other assets we have. We're going to have enough electricity generation capacity. Let's get the gas out of the grid so the prices come down in the grid. Not possible, sadly, because it's such a large percentage. If it would be 5, you could make it. If it's 42, there is no way for you to make it. And therefore, the price of gas will always also determine the price of electricity in the UK. Now, you have nuclear, but you're not doing a good job there. You're about as clumsy as the French when it comes to running them. And that has a lot to do that the EDF is running some of them for you in the UK. And that's a mistake, at least from, while EDF is so, useless in operating them. And so you need to fix that too. And I would like to see the UK, obviously, scale up its nuclear capacities for the good of everyone in the UK. And then the Ireland grid is as you would expect, quite dependent on the UK to import quite a bit of electricity. I think 20% of what they use is imported from the UK, or even a bit more than that now that I look at it.
Okay.
And Ireland is mainly a coal grid and again a natural gas grid, 46%, and then some crude oil even you still use there. Wow. So it's quite old fashioned and not a nice grid, not a, you know, talking about energy policy there in Ireland. Maybe someone wants to look at this in more detail and say, what's going on, guys?
Yeah, probably.
So if you're a net importer today, and if you use all the wrong, you know, I have nothing against coal and gas-fired plants in general from a long-term perspective, but you probably then have challenges ahead to decarbonize it in a certain way, although I think decarbonization needs to slow down to accommodate the people. The people today are more important than the climate in 30 years, right? We have to make sure we get through this patch. But the point is, why is there no nuclear? Why is there not enough capacity of other things? And it's just, there is a lot that needs to change when it comes to grids.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll finish off talking about...
In short, the UK is very vulnerable too.
The UK is very vulnerable. Yeah, indeed. Well, I don't want to talk about the United States, but in terms of how they're going to cope. But in terms of their ability to deliver LNG, I think were they in a quite strong position? I think I read that the United States can be ready to supply, certainly the UK and maybe a bit of Europe, with LNG. What, are you getting any read on perhaps imports of LNG coming from the United States into Europe?
Yeah, I mean, we have these numbers obviously to the penny, so where does Europe get, first of all, how much LNG did we import in 2021? We had, in 2021, we had a 480 BCM billion cubic meter gas market in Europe. And that's Europe, OECD Europe. So including Switzerland, I don't know where you're, all this called. The UK, you're not part of the EU these days. And we imported in 2021 106 BCMs of LNG for the year.
From the United States?
No, just in from LNG. Let me get to it in a moment. And then of that, about half came from the US.
Okay.
Now this year, in 2022, we're going to get that number up to 160 BCMs, because we obviously replace some of the gas that Russia doesn't deliver anymore. Russia, by the way, delivered 130 BCMs in 2021, ex-LNG. It also delivered some LNG. And now that number is as low as 46 for the moment, year to date.
Okay.
And falling every year, because now Nord Stream 1 is off too. And that has still functioned until July, and now it's not anymore. Which means, and here is, I think, the interesting angle that I'd like to answer within your question, which means we need more LNG, even more LNG imports next year. We assume we need about 200 BCMs of LNG imports next year.
Right.
To balance the market, even though we are saving 12%, let's say we keep savings at 15% for all of Europe, huh? Not just certain parts will have to save more, certain parts will have to save less. Let's leave that complexity aside for the moment. So if we save 15% and we like to balance the market, we need 200 BCMs of natural gas in 2023. And now is the question where it comes from. And often people already think, are skeptical and say, we cannot even regas that. So we cannot import it, right? You need a regasification terminal, which is nothing else but an import terminal where you do the liquefied, cooled down gas. You bring it back up to the form where we use it in our daily households. And that capacity, in my view, is going to be there. And while it wasn't all at the right places, we are improving a lot, certainly in the Netherlands, in Germany, and so on, to get it in place by January, December. Some of it is already in place now in the Netherlands newly. So there is kind of a war kind effort going on where we try and improve our import capacities. But here comes the big problem mark. Where will it come from in the market? And there your audience needs to know that LNG is usually a long-term business where clients from Korea, South Korea, or Japan, or Asia, sign up for a long-term contract with the Americas or with Qatar. And then they have their contract and they have their gas on a long-term basis, by the way, on much lower prices than Europe pays. And Europe wasn't going to do that. Why? Because, again, we decarbonize. We don't want natural gas. That was a big mistake. And it was a hasty mistake again, a hasty decision while the new is not there, the old is not supposed to come anymore. Big mistake, policy mistake. So now we have to look and find contracts that are available for us to buy in the market. And you can. How does it work? By having the highest price, mm-hmm. where the contract is what we have a destination free. And most US, or all of US contracts that come out of the US actually have destination freedom. So a Korean buyer can say, you know what, for that price, I'm happy to sell my cargo that I bought at 10 at 50 to Europe. And I make a big profit in between. And so I have a bit less natural gas, I'll find it elsewhere. And so that's what happened in 2022 in a crowd and 21 already in a rather efficient way. Everyone made a good deal out of Europe and they were happy to give us some of the gas. Now, here is the complexity. Now we get to the level going from 160 BCMs to 200, where it's very hard to explain where we get the 40 BCMs from in the open market. Because the US is maxed out for the moment. Yes, they will not be in 4 or 5 years, but for now they are maxed out. So we know all the contracts there. We know who can ship us gas there. And yes, some of that will change hands. But we need more than that. Where does it come from? The Russians already deliver what they deliver. Right? Russia still delivers LNG into Europe. Then there are the Qataris. The Qataris don't have destination freedom in their contract.
Okay.
Now, the Indians don't have destination freedom in their contract. However, they, and it's not the Indians providing natural gas, but it's the Indians having a contract with someone like Russia providing natural gas to them. What they have is often a breakup fee, so we can free up some of that where people say, oh, look, I look at this mathematically. If I break up this contract and deliver the cargo from someplace in Russia to India, instead to India to Europe, I make a nice business out of it despite paying a breakup fee. And some of that happened too. But it's okay. Still very little. So now the Qataris that are the other big exporters other than the US, they are at the same level, they are the same size. The problem there is the owner of the contract, say South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Malaysia, China, they cannot make a business out of it, giving that gas to Europe instead of using it for their own purposes. And so they will not. The only way they could allow Europe to contract more gas is by giving it back to the Qataris. But I would ask you, Mark, why would they do that when they can buy natural gas on the cheap and they need it? They don't hand it back to the Qataris.
Mm.
And the Qataris then would get the benefit of the higher price delivering it into Europe. And so this is where we are getting very careful about being as optimistic as we were last year, where many people told us, you know, the Europe is now not going to get enough gas. And I said, no, guys, you're wrong. I sent, by the way, a lot of tweets how we can do that and so on and looked into the details. And many people were just too shallow about it. But now I'm getting more skeptical because these additional 40 BCMs that we need to replace what we don't receive now in Nord Stream 1 on top of all the rest that we don't receive from Russia is going to be very hard to recontract.
Okay.
And that could mean we have to save another 5 to 10%, Mark. And if that is the case, then this really gets awkward.
Okay.
So I think people want to prepare that this is not about this winter. It's actually about going to be the next and
the next one.
So the next 3 winters is where we have to reinvent a lot of things here.
The next 3 winters.
Isn't even more scandalous when I say all that we are fighting nuclear in Europe in sentimental ways, where we say it's high risk and when we have proven over 5 decades now, how we can absolutely run that technology and provide the much needed energy to households we need. And at the same time, a small group of people, the Greens in Germany, have sort of somehow blocked that agenda and make us do things that literally means hundreds of people will go bankrupt for no good reason.
Yeah.
Thousands, hundreds of thousands will. Bakeries, you know? How can they survive this?
No, they can't. Someone was telling me the other day that the energy bill of the bakery went from, I don't know, it went to about 100,000 per month, effectively. That's what they can't. That's impossible to sustain. I think it was maybe under 10, something like that, and 10 times. It's not possible.
Some people have the ability from a product that is so important that they can pass on some of the price. But you and I are not gonna pay 20 euros for a piece of bread just because we want that piece of bread. We're not gonna.
No, no, it's not. Well, I started this podcast saying winter is coming and a whole bunch of people don't yet believe in White Walkers, but now I'm starting to think that the White Walkers will come again and get more the next year and the year after.
The electricity crisis, so the EDF problems, the nuclear problems, and call it the green shift requirement for decarbonization, cannot be managed or cannot be accommodated by the green technology available today. So the electricity price crisis is here to stay until we have the nuclear renaissance. And the gas crisis is also here to stay.
Okay. And this is not...
It's here to stay for 3 to 4 years. I think the gas crisis we have under control in 2026, maybe 2025, because really everyone knows it's a big problem and works hard on it. But the electricity crisis at the moment, in my view, there is zero shift in mindset at the policy level, policy maker level, at the politician level, or at voter level, where they say, hold on, what's going on here? So there is a big discovery process yet to come, where politicians, of course, use the moment and blame Putin when electricity prices are high.
Yeah.
Now so it's all Putin, right?
Yeah.
When Putin is 30% of it, now he's 100%. Because now he's 100%. Very convenient, isn't it?
It's very convenient. Yes, of course it's very convenient. Yeah. So we're going to have an energy crisis for a number of years. And this is not to do with the spot price, which of course has come down off the peak. But we're still going to have a crisis.
Because of the short squeezes, right? They come out. So some of the insane levels of 2,000 euro in peak loads out in the on the French curve, and so some of that comes down. That was completely homemade and can be addressed by either banks or by policymakers or by just clever crisis management. Let's get on with it. We can solve these problems. But the lack of generation capacity from reducing options months after months now for years is here to stay and means electricity prices will in fact stay much too high. So when they were 50 euro per megawatt hour in 2020, I think the new normal is 200 euro, 250 euro, and that is impossible for many industries to keep unit cost competitive, and it will be impossible or prove impossible for certain households to pay.
Yeah. There are two other things I want to discuss. I know we've probably been talking an hour now, but there are two more things I just want to discuss with you. First of all, it's how can people prepare for this and protect themselves to what's to come? And maybe more of a wider discussion. We can maybe do another podcast on this, on sort of the economy. But if we're talking about lots and lots of liquidations, many redundancies, that is extremely bad, obviously, for the markets, for the economy, but there's probably a wider discussion that we could have. But maybe if you've got a few thoughts on that now, and then really what people can do in the immediate term, you know, and then for the next sort of 2 years, what have you, to weather this storm that we're going to go through.
I try. obviously not my role. We run a hedge fund, but let me try and make sense somehow the bad news and put them in context. So what I would recommend, first of all, is to really follow people like us to read up and be informed, because when you start to accept what is coming, I think you achieved 50% of what you need to achieve. If you still think this is just a fluke, this is going away, come March, everything is back fine, back normal, you're going with the wrong mentality at the big structural problem. So I think acceptance is an important message that I'd like to pass on to everyone. Then two, I would say, and this sounds dramatic, but it's actually not so dramatic, but I think this is irresponsible of me to pass it on in that sense. People not just should assume certain shortages, but in a grid, when you have these situations accumulating, a blackout is a possibility. And while we are very capable operators, they often have a reaction time of less than a minute. And so how can you expect them to throw every problem at them every minute, all the time, more and more, and that they always keep it together? At some point, something will happen, will go wrong. And where that ever will be, people do are best off to then say, okay, let me understand what a blackout is. Let me read up. In the internet is full of information. What can I do myself? So you keep some money at home, cash, because you cannot get it out of the ATM. You make sure you have food storage there that for two or even 3 weeks that you are completely comfortable to have a nice family life and not suddenly be distressed because you don't have food. Because you cannot go to the next store nearby as you do now for years every single day because it's just not open. And then you start to go through that and make sure you have the water in place and so on. So we are no blackout advisory experts, but these are the kind of things you want to read up about. So you're prepared mentally there. And again, the blackout obviously will come in January, February, March. And if it hasn't come, then it could come again next year or the year after, because again, mm-hmm. problems don't go away, but it's a winter thing. Mm-hmm. It will not happen in the summer or in the months where we don't need as much electricity as we do in the winter. Mm-hmm. And then thirdly, and that's would be my hope, is to start to rethink what really matters and why. And when we are in this situation where we can clearly put our fingers on it and say so much of it is homemade, we have to start to think about the politicians and what they have told us and why. And then to go about these things more critically and say, no, enough is enough. You know, the world is not going to burn in 30 years. And in the meantime, I cannot go bankrupt and I don't want to go up miserably in Europe. What is this? I mean, we absolutely need cheap energy. And then let's go about that in a scientific way and not in a ideological way where we exclude all sorts of technology that is out there in the market only because a few dictated so. I mean, who is to say that coal doesn't work if we do carbon capture? Mm-hmm. Why is that technology excluded when it's the cheapest? Why is nuclear such a high-risk technology? Is that really true? Is this really scientific? And who pays the insurance cost of the blackout when it arrives? And what are the costs there? Why is this never balanced out, you know, like a formula rather than just one extreme where everyone says, potential climate damage in 30 years, as if it comes in 30 years on day one, right? It's a process that takes hundreds of years. And yes, it's there and we want to work on it, but we want to work in a way without us destroying ourselves and destroying our wealth and our accomplishments for the last 50 years that three generations accomplished for us. We just throw it all away on one narrative, which is climate change. And without allowing technology to actually work on the problem, just because a few politicians say, no, we can only build wind farm and solar, sorry, all the rest we don't want, and then that cannot help because it just doesn't have the capacity or cannot match the grid in terms of timing or location. Because again, it's not just about the asset and the emissions of the asset. So I would really enjoy when people start to read up on these things in serious ways and instead of looking at it Well, there is a lot of misinformation out there, and there is a lot of lobbying out there. And you want to go about the scientific books where you really get a fair picture. Or follow us, and then from time to time we mention books and so on. So the people become their own, you know, the owners again of the understanding, rather than being manipulated, and then we are running in the wrong direction. We have to change, Padma. We have to change our policies, and if we don't do, these problems don't go away. They don't resolve themselves.
Okay. So, well, thank you for that. Will you be stocking up your pantry?
I will, yeah. I'll do that. I just make, sadly, Switzerland is also in a strong winter, is also a net importer, and I don't mind Germany providing it to us. The French have their problems. So Switzerland, the Swiss grid is warning about it, of shortages of electricity now.
I heard they were already warning.
I have to say that we made mistakes, but at least the authorities are very open about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because in this direct democracy, you don't get away with it. So the Swiss grid was warning as the authority of the grid. Then every politician now at its level is clearly talking about it and how do we address it and so on. So we're in a process of adjustment, but we are the direct democracy and people, you know, they're not going to take it from the politicians if they don't.
No. What about, are you going to buy a little generator just in case?
No, I don't do that. I don't think that's the solution. I think... I make sure I have gas availability so I can cook.
Okay.
Because everything is electricity where I live, in my household. So I need to make sure I can warm up things.
Yeah, sure.
And then I organize the rest, you know, the information. I want to have a radio that can receive the transmission so I know. But again, I'm not obsessed about these things. I hope it's not going to get bad, but...
Yeah.
Why would I be lazy with all my information I have not to prepare myself, not to make this the most awkward experience, or even, you know, a matter of life and death for myself or my family? I'm not going to do that. So I think some prevention is just, you also bring a ski suit to your skiing vacation. You just don't go with your bear suit and say, by the way, no one told me it's going to be minus 20 degrees.
Yeah, well, let's hope it doesn't get to that stage. But I think it's very important what you say about informing yourself. Forewarned is forearmed is a phrase that...
You go in the mental process and you can decide for yourself, and some will take it more seriously, some will take it less seriously, some will forget about two days later about it. But it's a starting point and probably the most important. Rather than saying, no, there is nothing wrong here and we're always going to have the electricity as we had for the last 50 months. Now, that I can guarantee you that this is not going to be the case.
Yeah.
We're all going to go through curtailments. It doesn't matter where in Europe.
Well, thank
except
you so.
I should say, except Norway and Sweden and Finland, what I mentioned before. I think they're going to be fine. The UK, not so sure it's fine. Ireland is not fine, but the Scandis are.
The Scandis are okay, or maybe we can all go and go.
Maybe we have to move there, right?
Maybe we have to move there, yeah. Listen, Alexander, thank you so much for your time. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of information there that you've distilled very well for us. I hope everyone has found it as interesting as I have. A lot of new insights there that I had no idea about, and you are really the man with the ear to the ground on this. So thank you really so much for your time. I think we will leave a discussion perhaps on the wider economy and what's happening, and of course with commodities as well, because there will be an opportunity at some point, as we said before, that once in a lifetime opportunity, but we'll have to leave that for another podcast. But for now, thank you very much, Alexander Starhill there from
Thank you so much for having me on. Very kind of you.